on Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews. Our February interview is with Charmaine Lovegrove. Charmaine is the co-founder, managing director and publisher of Dialogue, a division in Hachette UK. She was the recipient of the Future Book Publishing Person of the Year in 2018 and has also worked in television, PR, as a literary editor and bookshop owner. She is founding editor of the Black Writers Guild. The interviewer is Yole Dexter.
Hi, Charmaine. Nice to meet you, albeit over the phone. Thanks so much.
Really lovely to meet you.
I'll just say a little bit about myself. I'm a bookseller at Piccadilly Waterstones and a blogger and a writer. And this is going to be my first piece for Write On. So you live and work between Berlin and Britain. How is having your foot in both countries shaping the work that you're doing? And how would you say the cities kind of relate to your sense of identity and belonging?
Wow, big questions. Okay, so I'm from London. I'm from a Jamaican British family. And here, you know, what's really interesting was that I was raised in an ethnic minority family, but not an immigrant family because my parents were born in Britain. And here I am a mother of three children. And so both my partner and I, then we are both British. So we actually raise our children as immigrants, as within an immigrant family. And so I think that really informs my work a lot in terms of one, living somewhere with a different language, different culture, and just different sensibilities, but also bringing in those sensibilities from the Caribbean and from Britain as well. And then when I'm back in London, then, you know, I can really see the difference of what it means to live in a properly multicultural city. London's super multicultural. I'd say Berlin is very international. And I'd say that that's the difference. And then how that really informs my work is that super inspired by the literary landscape in Germany and Berlin and how books are really important and sort of at the centre of creative culture in Germany. And in Britain, it's really sad to see all the libraries closing. You know, I'm happy that there's more and more independent bookshops. There's more Waterstones opening. And we've got bookshop.org online. Like there's, you know, there's more happening in terms of book selling, but like in terms of libraries and that kind of cultivation, then we don't have, you know, a lot of libraries are closing down. So that's always really difficult to see. And then in terms of rights and in terms of what books get sold, et cetera, then it's really different, like what sells where. And so it helps me to think about audience from a greater perspective.
What would you say is the reality of publishing marginalized voices?
I think the kind of reality of publishing marginalized voices is just the constant fear that every voice gets sort of turned into a trend or becomes part of a trope, and that we don't get to have expansive, nuanced lives like majority white, middle class, cisgendered, heterosexual people. You know, it's like they can be individuals and we don't get to be. And so I think there's like a limit of understanding of like what it really means to be a multicultural person, which means that we inhabit all of the different entities from the people that we live around, or the country of which we share a majority with. We do share that as well. Then we have additional cultures and additional layers. And I think the idea that it's just difference, as opposed to looking at like what's inclusive, I think is something that really surprises me more than anything else.
Yeah. And on to Dialogue and everything that you've done for Dialogue, I'm interested to know about what the transition was like from starting Dialogue and it being an imprint of Little Brown to its being its own division of Hachette. What's changed the most, would you say?
Well, you know, Dialogue actually started as a bookshop in Berlin and then has like three or four iterations before becoming an imprint. So in some ways, the division isn't as big as becoming an imprint from becoming a bookshop. But in other ways, it's like dramatically different because my responsibilities are different. So how I look at the P&L, how I look at like the budgets and everything in terms of very practical things of like how we contribute to Hachette is different to contributing to Little Brown on a financial level. Having two distinct imprints, for example, Dialogue Books, our literary imprint, and also Renegade, that's headed up by Christina Demosthenes. Then, you know, that's really different, having the commercial imprint as well. And then just working with so many people, like before I worked by myself, the only person that commissioned on Dialogue, and then Amy Baxter joined us and she commissioned as we were becoming a division. And then now we have five people that commission, and we have a project editor, and we have an editorial assistant, and we have a head of marketing and head of publicity. So, you know, that's like the core Dialogue team. And that's just like a totally different thing for me to work with so many people. And it's such a pleasure to be so collaborative with so many different creative and hardworking and very passionate minds.
From what you said about kind of your responsibilities being different now, and you're contributing to Hachette, and you're, you know, your mind is thinking from like a financial perspective, and you have commercial imprints. Could you talk a bit about kind of risk and reward when you're publishing stories from authors and perspectives that are marginalized in the mainstream? How is that mindset of risk and reward coming into play commercially and from the sales perspective that you have to take now?
You know, I also think it's really important to be careful with this idea of like what's marginalized from the mainstream and who the mainstream is. Like I was saying, you know, we are, as people who are from multicultural backgrounds and people who have different protected characteristics, like we're also part of the mainstream. I was walking on the road yesterday and I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about the war in Gaza and Israel and what it actually means to be multicultural, what it means to be part of something that's bigger. And I think, you know, when I walked down the road, as I was walking down the road, I was saying, it's so interesting because we were talking specifically about books and how sometimes people, other publishers publish books, sort of try and publish them directly to Black people. But then because they don't work with that many Black people, it's like a Black author and a Black protagonist, they don't work with that many Black people, then I can really see how they're getting it wrong, because they're trying to talk to people that they have a really set idea on, like what it is that we're interested in. And none of our like plethora of like individuality, nuances, ideals, values, etc., as individuals gets taken on board, right? Whereas when I publish a book like The Vanishing Half, I'm publishing it for everybody. And like, so when I was walking down the road, I was saying, look, I'm walking past on my street, I'm walking past a French deli, then I'm going to walk past a Spanish wine shop, then I'm going to walk past a German bakery, then I'm going to walk past a Polish food shop. You know, it's like all of those things exist on our high streets as normal. But this idea of like constantly trying to marginalize us, you know, kind of keep telling us that we're different. It's like, who does that benefit? Why is that happening? And also, like, what does that even mean? And why are we sort of kind of considered as like different to people in our society when actually we have all of the things that somebody white and middle class, for example, knows, plus we have an abundance of extra knowledge and culture. And why is that seen as like different? Why is that not seen as being part of the mainstream, actually? As, you know, that's just othering. So I would just say that like my approach is to doggedly advocate for people who are marginalized and minoritized, but at the same time also be very clear that we are also part of something that is part of wider society and the mainstream. Like you can shop in a Black Afro shop and still go to Marks and Spencer's. Do you know, like those things aren't separate. So this idea that you have to constantly only show us things within like a very kind of skewed, small, ghettoized version of itself, and that's the only way that we're going to see it, is like entirely wrong. It kind of just doesn't make any sense to me, and it has to be seen in its like broadest, most positive, most engaging terms.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say then you kind of almost like refute the wording of the question because it's not giving an accurate representation of the whole?
Yeah, like, why should... Yeah. Like, it's like, why... What does... Okay, so I'm a Black queer woman. Why do I have to why am I minoritized or marginalized? Like, why is that? Like, that's also just not how I feel. You know, that's like not live in the world. Like, I don't walk into the world being like carrying all of this. I'm really aware of is structures, you know, and I'm of structural racism and structural inequality where people aren't given the fairest opportunity because of empire of 400 because of history, you know, 450 years of slave trade and 250 years of colonialism and the ownership of people, right, and the oppression of people. That's like where we're really coming from in this. And the idea that we are then like just constantly like, why are we marginalized? Like, who is marginalizing us, and who is and is that really understood? And I just don't, and I think it's I just don't really think it's sort of understood what it means. And also, like, where are you?
I'm absolutely fascinated by your answer, Charmaine, because I'm part German. I was born in Germany. I found out in the late 90s that my grandfather was actually First Nation Canadian. You know, I've been brought up with feet in both Germany and England, and I'm bilingual. However, I sound posh and I look white, you know, so therefore, my first book was based on my research at my First Nation family. But because I lived as a, I don't want to say posh, English woman, I was actually, there was a real issue in terms of being able to write from that perspective. So I think that othering actually works both ways. I think that that kind of, you know, terming each other as other instead of seeing the whole, I think can have incredibly negative connotations on both sides. And of course, that goes into cultural appropriation as well. But I'm really fascinated by what you're saying. And I think especially that kind of trope, that desire to kind of color everything with the same brush in our world, which, you know, diaspora nations are becoming huge, you know, the millions and millions, I think 100 million diaspora at the last count, you know, those layers of identity and belonging, very, very different to what they once were and actually should be celebrated. But I think my point is the othering can actually come from both sides. So if you're seemingly posh and white and middle class, actually, that might not be the entire story, but that can be subscribed, that can be your identity.
Yeah, but that's why I'm like, it doesn't even make sense to me. You know? Like, you know, I remember when George Floyd was murdered and people were basically telling me that they felt really sorry for me because I was black. And I was like, didn't your dad die of COVID? Or like, didn't you just find out that you have cancer? Or didn't you find, like, I was like, all these things that are really hard happen to you. And like, that's really shocking. That's really shocking and really sad. But yet you think that the worst thing that could possibly happen in the world is like me to be black. That's just so racist, basically. Like, that is racism, right? Because that's
absolutely.
But I had hundreds of people being really well-meaning literally saying that to me.
But
which bit of it?
Terrible.
Like, the bit that's terrible is that we have to endure structural inequality, you know. Like, the bit that's terrible is that we're not able to meet each other where we are and try and understand each other as individuals. Like, the bit that's terrible is being underestimated and undermined because of presumptions and prejudice. Like, those are the bits that are really terrible. The bit that are amazing is being able to be reflective upon and living with, you know, embracing different cultures. The bit that's really amazing is like the food, the history, etc. You know, like, the abundance of like that comes from knowing that your family survived. A bit like with Jewish people, how they're like, every child that's born is really a blessing, right? Because you know, because of the oppression and because of the Holocaust, because of how many people died. And that's how I feel. Like, I feel like I'm the child of people that wanted to survive, that willed themselves to survive. And here I am. And then I've got some person who like doesn't know their history, their culture, doesn't know anything, you know, other than the fact that they're like white and English, and, you know, hasn't lived in other places, doesn't speak other language, doesn't have a multicultural life. Like, the fact that someone like that is telling me that I am a minority when I'm part of the global majority in the world, and I'm also part of a majority in London. So I'm like, where am I a minority? You know, like, where are you getting that? Being a monocultural person is not something to be proud of. It's not something that's of interest. The reason that we go to books and stories is to learn about other people, and this multicultural experience, which so many of us inhabit, is what keeps the stories going. Without us, there's no stories, right? Because there's not many experiences, and you're all living the same experiences. So for me, it's like, it's just a really weird understanding of like,
why is somebody that has more being told that they are less? Just doesn't make any logical sense.
And that's where I'm like, I just, so with the question, I'm like, if you're coming from a monocultural white middle class lens in Britain, do you see me or my authors like in that sort of minority space? But actually outside of publishing, that's just like not true, right? Like we're the abundance and we're the global majority, and like we're here, I'm not going anywhere. So it's like, actually, how is it? The question is really, how is it that you take people who are from a limited background to be able to see the abundance of brilliance from people from a multicultural background? Like, that's my reframing of it.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about the advisory board on dialogue, how you've got individuals.
I haven't set that up yet, actually, but.
Maybe kind of.
We'll do at some point next year, but this year was about building the team.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's such a great, an important idea, and I just wanted to mainly just ask about how and kind of who, because like, where are you sourcing the people? Is it like doctors and nurses, and you're just getting loads of different people with different experiences and jobs? And
I mean, the thing is, it's like, there's just, again, like, I'm from the world, so it's really interesting to me. It's like, I'm not even prescriptive about what it looks like. It's more about the fact that there's just different types of people who are really interested in literature and who have connections to audiences that I think could really help us to develop key projects and just like new ways of thinking and new ways of engaging. But because I've got such a brilliant team already and they're really new, you know, I really love to give things time to percolate. And so rather than kind of bringing in this advisory board sort of immediately, everyone's got so many ideas and everyone's doing so much and acquiring so many books and has so many different ideas about how to reach new audiences. They're all new and we're all figuring out how to work together. So this doesn't feel like an opportune time.
Write On magazine, it's been built on kind of co-creation. Essentially, the writers are the readers. I'm just interested if you feel that kind of collaborative, like back and forth relationship between readers and writers would enter the publishing world.
That collaboration between readers and writers entering the publishing world.
Yeah.
All I know is that people are like incredibly creative. And when I see people on TikTok with their books, like that they're reading, when I ask, you know, when I see people doing things like creating annotated videos of their annotated books and reading lines out and kind of just getting other people on board, then I just think, wow, you've like not only read the book, you've read it really deeply, you've made annotations, then you decide to create a video, and you've made that video super engaging, and now other people are going to buy the book. We're pretty amazing as human beings. I don't really spend that much time sort of thinking about what you've asked in a way, because I just think, the more open we are, the more different types of books we have, the more different types of readers will come to it, the more different types of writers we'll have. It's just that simple. And our job is just to be open and rather than prescriptive and be transparent and engaged. Like that's what we do, that's what we can bring, that's what can happen.
I remember it was before my time at Pen to Print, because I created Write On for them, and we started in 2019. But I remember you touched base with Lena very early on, when she was just starting out with Pen to Print, and that was all about, obviously, it's Arts Council funded, it's now an Arts Council MPO, but that was all about obviously bringing the working class multicultural writing into a way of being published and being heard, which is a dynamic of Pen to Print. Do you remember that initial contact?
It was with
Lena Smith, because it would have been about 2016, 2017.
Yeah, when I just think about the volume of people that I've met in the last month, Frankfurt, let alone since 2016. Like, you know, I used to have a bookshop and I've worked in many bookshops. And when you're someone, you know, when I do many events and when you're someone that's kind of public facing in that way, like a shop, then you know that lots of people know you. So often I walk down the road and people are like, hi. And I'm like, hi. And then they don't even like say their name or anything to me because they remember me. And then I'm supposed to remember. I know it sounds really arrogant. I'm not like famous by any stretch of the imagination, but I just know a lot. I've just met like so many people and I just can't even think about all of the all of the conversations I've had. And so I'm really sorry that I can't remember.
No, but what is interesting, it's ripple effects, Charmaine. You create ripple effects. And what I would say is when I first met Lena, you were in a really early conversation in terms of she'd heard you speak, she'd connected with you, and you shifted. You really inspired what she wanted to do. And I mean, that project now, it's huge, and Right On has come from that. And we reach a lot. So isn't that the ripple effects which your candor and your authenticity and your passion has created actually have come full circle back to this conversation now, because you inspired Lena really early on?
That's amazing. I'm really pleased to hear that like you have all of these conversations and you say these things, and like for me I'm just kind of speaking an absolute truth.
Yeah, well that's what comes across. And I think that's how you inspire, because you summarize in a very clear and concise way exactly what you want to say and what matters to you.
There's just two last questions, and one is just could be just a one-word answer. So before I go on to that one, I know you did say that you like to kind of take your time and see how things go. But I am so interested to know about any future plans and just kind of next steps.
In terms of books, then we've got an incredible array of books for next year. It really feels like a division for next year in terms of our titles across Renegade and Dialogue Books. We've got Swift River by Essie J. Chambers that I sort of think of as Vanishing Half meets Crawdad. We have Shanghai Landers by Julie Min, which we think of as doing for Shanghai what James Joyce did for Dublin. We have Memory Piece by Lisa Coe. That the closest that I can get to the brilliance that was Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Then we have on Renegade, Paula Sutton. Some people know her as Auntie Paula. Paula, she's got a cozy crime debut, and that's coming out called The Plotting Shed Murder. And we've just got so many books next year. We've got like 45, 50 books now. And, you know, going from a list that had sort of 12 a year to 50 already is like absolutely amazing. We've got Winter Animals by Shani Lewis. That's kind of White Lotus meets The Secret History. So, you know, we've got a lot.
And on that note about books, if you could make a law that everyone in the world had to read one book, what would that book be?
The Vanishing Half by Brit Bennett. I mean, it just does a lot, but I mean, it's hard, like a really, really difficult question. But the fact that it's so intersectional is what is really incredible. And it's about that human journey. So yeah, that's what I love about it.
Thank you to Charmaine Lovegrove for being the subject of this month's interview. As always, we'll share links so you can find out more about her work in our show notes. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write On Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for Pen to Print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.